Want to go through some pictures?
Sure.
See if it jogs your memory a little bit?
Yep.
All right, cool. You got a bunch.
A couple producers and I recently sat down with Emmanuel Fair in Seattle. We brought with us a stack of black and white photographs showing a group of 20-somethings in Halloween costumes, all congregating in the apartments of the Valley View.
Well, Emmanuel, you can just kind of go through them. So tell us who these people are right here.
One by one, Emmanuel lifted up each picture, turning it this way, that.
Okay, so this looks like the back of Arpana.
She's standing right there with her back to us.
The Halloween party at the Valley View had taken place more than a decade earlier. It lasted a grand total of 7 hours. But looking at the photos, it all came hurtling back to Emmanuel. The outfits, the decorations, the layout of the rooms.
Okay, so this is in front of Leslie's, and this is the table that we set up with the food, and that's Arpana at the table.
Emmanuel's talking about a woman named Leslie Potts. She was a friend of Emmanuel's and the only person at the Valley View who he knew before the party. He was crashing on Leslie's couch that weekend, and it was through Leslie that he met some of the other party attendees, like Neil Marshall, the self-proclaimed arm wrestling champ.
Neil was a little over the top. Then he, you know, sucker punched me.
How did you prevent yourself from not immediately punching him in the face?
I mean, because I knew he did it on an accident, you know what I'm saying? I would be the bad guy if I, you know what I'm saying?
As for Cameron Johnson, Arpana's neighbor, of course Emmanuel had not forgotten him.
Yeah, he came through because the door was open. And then I remember Arpana introducing him to everybody in there. And then he was like, I got alcohol. And then a few people went next door to his place, grabbed the bottle and came back over.
Finally, near the end of the stack of photos, we landed on a familiar face. Emmanuel smiled.
Okay, yeah, this next one's me with the construction gear on. I didn't know about the party, so they had to like come together and put some costume together for me. So that was pretty neat that they did that.
Can you describe the different pieces in that costume?
Okay, I got the knee pads. I got a tool belt. Got some little protective glasses and the hard hat. That's pretty much it. I don't think there was no hammers or anything. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
The photographer who took these photos could never have guessed at their importance when he took them. The photo of Emmanuel is innocuous on its own. It's just Emmanuel staring back at the camera out from under the lid of his helmet, surrounded by other partygoers. But soon enough, it would be the image that helped alter the entire course of the investigation. In a very real sense, this image was the start of everything. Everything that came next for Emmanuel.
He was amongst the people depicted in the party photos. He was dressed up as a construction worker. He was the only African-American male at the party that I could see from the photos. People knew him by his first name only, Emmanuel.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products
Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME.
From Campside Media and Wondery, I'm Matthew Scheer, and this is Suspect. This is episode 4, The Old Ways. In the fall of 2008, Detective Brian Coates had spread the same photos from the party across his desk at the Redmond Police Station until they formed one big array of faces, most of which belonged to witnesses who had already come in for interviews, residents of the Valley View or close friends of residents. At this point in the investigation, the Redmond PD had just one person of interest, Cameron Johnson. Cameron had acknowledged he was attracted to Arpana Janaga. He'd attempted to drive to Canada without a passport after her murder, and he'd subsequently lied to police about his activities that morning. But Coates still considered the investigation to be very much open, and it seemed to him to be worth running down the guy in the construction worker outfit, especially since he'd appeared in at least one photo with the murder victim. But all the police knew about the guy in the construction worker outfit was his first name.
We put a bulletin together, trying to identify him with a picture of his photo, a close-up of some tattoos on his hand, and kind of a do-you-know-me type bulletin sent out to detectives and agencies in the region. And almost immediately, we got several responses back from law enforcement agencies and corrections who identified the person as Emmanuel Fair.
Those same agencies gave Coates and his colleagues a full name and a date of birth, which meant Coates could pull together a brief biographical sketch of this new potential person of interest. He was a young man whose mother had struggled with addiction and wasn't able to take care of him. He'd bounced between different family members before finally running away at age 16 and ending up in a foster care group home. He had known gang affiliations and a criminal record. When he was 16, Emmanuel had been arrested for mugging another neighborhood teen. When he was 17, he'd allegedly fired a pistol into the wall at his foster home. Not long after, he was rung up for cocaine possession after cops stopped him with a couple other guys. Police said one of them had been carrying a handgun and showing it off to his other two friends. I've read each of the police reports for these incidents, and it's clear to me that in nearly every instance, had Emmanuel had more resources, better attorneys, or let's face it, if his skin had been a different color, he would never have been incarcerated for these crimes. In fact, he might never have been charged in the first place. It doesn't take a particularly deep dive into the stats to know that Black people in most cities in the U.S. have far more contact with police than whites. Seattle is no exception. Since 2012, the city has been under a so-called consent decree after the Department of Justice concluded the local police department had a bunch of policies in place that were biased against minorities. Black people in Seattle are frisked at higher rates than white people. Black people are incarcerated at higher rates and make up disproportionate percentages of the prison and jail populations. I bring all of this up because context is important when it comes to Emmanuel's criminal history. For example, take that cocaine arrest. Emmanuel was not stopped because police had evidence he had committed a crime. They stopped him because he was walking with a guy who was carrying a handgun. Once police caught up with Emmanuel, they cuffed him and searched him twice. only on the second search did they find a tiny trace of cocaine in his pocket, so small that he was charged with misdemeanor possession, not a more serious offense like intent to distribute. Emmanuel is just 18 years old. Still, he got a month in King County Jail, where he was housed with thousands of adults awaiting trial for felony crimes. That isn't to say Emmanuel wasn't breaking the law back then. He admits he was dealing drugs. He admits he sometimes did carry an unlicensed gun. But as a teenager, he was already in an adversarial relationship with the law, already in and out of prison, not getting cut the slightest break. So that's part of Emmanuel's rap sheet. But then there's a far more serious incident that me and the other producers have spent hours wrangling with. An incident which ultimately put Emmanuel Fair squarely in the crosshairs of the Redmond PD and persuaded some of the investigators into the murder of Arpanaginaga that he might be capable of extreme violence. Here are the details as we understand them. In late 2003 and early 2004, Emmanuel was 20 years old and living part-time with a man he had come to believe was his father. The man had a girlfriend, and this girlfriend had a daughter. We're going to call her Jennifer. Jennifer was 15. In early 2004, Jennifer called 911. She said that Emmanuel had raped her the night before, around 1 a.m., after pulling a gun on her. She said that she tried to push him off, but couldn't, all the while telling him to stop. But Emmanuel had slapped her and choked her and threatened to kill her. We've spoken to the SVU detective who investigated the case and to the victim, who stood by her story, but declined to be interviewed on the record. According to the SVU detective, when Emmanuel was told the DNA test would be taken, he admitted, okay, he and Jennifer did have a sexual relationship, but nothing was coerced. Jennifer was a minor, so she couldn't legally give consent. Emmanuel was admitting he'd committed statutory rape. From here, things get murky and unresolved, as they often do in sexual assault cases. Prosecutors downgraded the charges to third-degree rape. Emmanuel submitted an Alford plea. For those of you who aren't familiar with Alford pleas, they're often used by people who lack the resources to mount a substantial defense, who have been through the wringer of the criminal justice system enough to know that a plea is going to be the speediest way to end the proceedings, and to avoid the kind of jail time that can be levied at the conclusion of a trial. An Alford plea allows a defendant to assert innocence, even while acknowledging that prosecutors likely have enough evidence to get a conviction. When I spoke to Detective Brian Coates, I asked him about Emmanuel's rape case. How did it factor into your thinking, I wondered.
Whether he was involved or not, you don't know that just based on prior criminal acts.
Later, though, I went back and listened to the tape of the pre-trial interview Coates had given in 2016 as Arpana's case headed to court. And I noticed that his answer back then had been extremely different.
Was that significant to you in any way?
It was significant, for sure.
Okay, how so?
Well, you have a sex offense, potential sex offense, obviously. We have a person who, regardless of his involvement, has some history of a sex offense.
Okay. What to you is the significance of a prior conviction for a sex offense in the context of this case?
If you've done it before, you'll do it again.
Two different answers to the same question. Why? Well, probably because, in my opinion, Brian Coates now understands how it sounds to say those words out loud. That, quote, if you've done it before, you'll do it again. And how does it sound? Well, not great, right? It sounds like you're making an assumption that one bad act is always indicative of a pattern of bad acts. But I believe the version he gave in that pre-trial interview. Coates saw a person with a rape charge on his record, which was enough to transform Emmanuel, in Coates' mind, from a dude in a photograph wearing a hard hat to a person of interest. Which is why, by mid-November of 2008, he had intensified his search for Emmanuel Fair. To find him, he started with the person who had invited Emmanuel to the party, Leslie Potts.
Leslie was the tenant of the Valley View who invited Emmanuel over for the weekend because Emmanuel had nowhere else to stay that weekend. She knew him, what she told us, just by a first name that they had met on MySpace at the time. And that they had been casual acquaintances for the preceding 6 months or so. But it was her apartment that Emmanuel visited and made him available for this Halloween party.
Leslie was 32 at the time of Arpanejanaga's murder, a little older than the other residents, and also a new arrival. What Coach just said is accurate, according to Emmanuel. The pair had met online, bonded over their love of hip-hop, met up once or twice in person. There was nothing romantic between them, nothing sexual. Speaking to Coates, Leslie promised to tell Emmanuel that the Redmond PD was looking for him.
We found out through wearing down the boot leather where he was likely staying, which was in the central district of Seattle at a house. We set up surveillance on the house, and we solicited the assistance of our plainclothes unit to do surveillance throughout the night.
Coates knew that if he could find Emmanuel, the rest would come relatively easily. He discovered that Emmanuel had failed to update his address with his probation officer, which he was obligated to do as a registered sex offender. That meant that there was a warrant out for his arrest, which meant Emmanuel could be hauled in for questioning, whether he liked it or not.
Our intention was to pick him up on the outstanding warrants as a reason to kind of get our hands on him and then use that opportunity to interview him about his knowledge of the party.
It's an old ploy that police have used for decades and that tends, as with most practices in modern policing, to disproportionately affect people of color. Grab your person of interest first, figure out the rest later. A few days after Coates had first looked through Emmanuel's priors, Coates and his partner and two backup police officers descended on Emmanuel as he was leaving a friend's house in the central district of Seattle. The backups drew their guns, pointed them at Emmanuel's chest, while Coates and his partner, both of whom were in street clothes, pulled Emmanuel into an unmarked car. For the next 20 minutes, with Emmanuel in the back seat, one cop sitting next to him and the other driving, the lights of Seattle flashing through the windows, Coates and his partner peppered Emmanuel with questions. Tell us about the party. Tell us about Arpana. Tell us about your movements. Not once was Emmanuel read his rights.
And they started driving. It was one detective driving, one sitting in the backseat with me, recording, asking about the party, different things, and like they were trying to figure out who's who and what's what.
I was amazed at his memory, even though he had just met all the people at the party. He could recall an extraordinary amount of names.
I was trying to help him the best I could. You know, then they just start talking about, give us some insight on this, you know.
Eventually, Emmanuel and the detectives arrived at Redmond Police Headquarters and the questioning continued. Emmanuel sketched out a timeline for Coates. He'd partied, ended up at Arpana's apartment near the end of the night where he met Cameron. He'd wandered back to Leslie's apartment, went to bed, woke up the next morning. He certainly hadn't killed Arpana, and no, he didn't know who did. Later, Coates dropped Emmanuel at King County Jail. When he finally met with his probation officer a few days later, he was told he was being released. He was not doing time for this violation, but the probation officer warned him, the Redmond PD are looking at you, and seriously. In fact, Coates spent the next couple of days trying to corroborate some of the statements Emmanuel had provided. In his mind, there was a lot that was not matching up.
He said he was retiring for the night of 1:30, 2 in the morning, acknowledged calling a buddy one time, and then didn't use the phone the rest of the night. When you pull the phone records, it shows him making several calls, sending several text messages, really beginning around that 3 o'clock hour, just before 3 in the morning, going all night long to 4 o'clock, 4:30, 4:45. He's making calls, receiving calls. Phone records show that he's calling Leslie Potts at the 4 o'clock hour. You know, the question is, why are you calling Leslie when you said that you're at the apartment sleeping? One of them was a voicemail that was just no voice, but the sound of movement.
Coates learned other calls had been placed to a number that belonged to a woman named Christina, a sex worker based in South Seattle, not far from SeaTac Airport. At first, Christina was uncooperative. She said she didn't know an Emmanuel Fair. But then she reversed course. Yeah, okay, she knew him. He'd called on Halloween night, but she had not driven out to Redmond to meet him. Meanwhile, Coates had found some evidence that at one point, a few months earlier, Emmanuel had helped Leslie post some ads for sex work, something both Leslie and Emmanuel confirmed to me. At the time, Leslie did not have a computer, and Emmanuel did. He never charged her for it. It was a favor, Leslie said. But to Coates, it indicated that maybe Emmanuel was pimping Leslie, which both Leslie and Emmanuel say is false. Still, Coates would later acknowledge in his pretrial interview that this development, combined with the images he'd seen on Emmanuel's social media pages, meant things were coming into focus.
There was photos of him displaying a lot of cash that I looked at on some computers. Mm-hmm. The industry of creating rap music, having a lot of cash, having women that are known prostitutes. It's not a far stretch to think that he might be in the business of profiting off of women. Back in that time, the gang activity in the area has kind of given way a little bit to now gangbangers now promoting prostitution.
Other than what you've just described, I mean, was there any other actual evidence to support that he was a pimp for anyone?
It might come back to me really later, but right now I can't recall any other evidence to suggest that.
Okay.
The theory, well, it is a stretch, right? It's more than that, really. Emmanuel is black, Emmanuel enjoyed rap music, and he was friends with Leslie, so hey, maybe he was a pimp. Even after his interviewer expresses surprise at the theory, Coates goes on speculating anyway. Maybe Emmanuel wanted sex, couldn't get it from any of the sex workers he knew, and so he walked upstairs looking for someone, anyone, to sleep with.
And then at some point, Arpana, because she's a female and was attractive, possibly, was subject to rape, or initially attempted rape, which resulted in the murder.
Okay.
So you kind of put all that together, and it's logical.
Okay.
By the time I visited the Valley View Apartments in 2020, Leslie Potts was long gone. A young woman and her husband had moved into her old unit. They had no idea where Leslie was. Neither did Emmanuel Fair, neither did Brian Coates. I finally found Leslie via Facebook. She'd relocated to a city far away. I'm not going to name it here to protect her privacy. After a couple exchanges, Leslie agreed that a field producer could visit her at her apartment for an interview.
Mic check 1, 2, mic check 1, 2.
Mic check 1, 2, mic check 1, 2.
Perfect.
Are you guys all set up and everything?
I'm set up, I'm recording, I have everything ready to go.
Okay. Leslie, tell us about the room that you're sitting in right now.
We just moved in here, me and my roommate. Not put together yet.
Leslie was nervous. Scott, the field producer, told us later that he could see her hands shaking.
So what are you looking at when you look around the room?
Oh, I see the Serenity Prayer.
The Serenity Prayer. What does the Serenity Prayer say?
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
She gave us an abbreviated personal history. She spent her early childhood in Texas, then moved to Washington State as a kid, then started to drift. By her 20s, she was in a kind of spiral.
I was in an active addiction then, so it was a lot of just dumb stuff. And I lived in Tukwila, Washington, on the Pacific Highway. There's a lot of hotels on there, so I would go hotel to hotel to hotel. So anything I could do to make money, I was doing it.
Did you get in trouble with the police at any point in your 20s?
Yeah, I did in my 20s, 30s, not my 40s. Yeah, I went to jail a few times for like dumb stuff like driving without a license or solicitation or stolen cars. That was my first one, but nothing really major.
Leslie moved into the Valley View in 2008, the year of the Halloween party. Ironically, the apartment, which her mom rented for her, was her way of getting off the street. It was a reset. She got clean, got a job at a cafe.
I felt like I was in a bubble of my own. Like, a bunch of people that I didn't fit in with in my head. You know, I probably look like I do, but in my head, I didn't fit in with them. But I was just working and just focusing on being a better person. So it didn't bother me, but it's like a little more, like, more expensive. Like, everyone was kind of stuck up a little bit. But I was happy because I had my own place, and so I was safe, you know?
Gradually, Leslie got to know her neighbors. She got to like them.
And I met Arpana upstairs, met her upstairs, and she was really cool. And then I started going over to her house for, like, dinner or whatever.
Can you tell us when you first met Emmanuel, how you met him?
I met him on MySpace, actually. That was when MySpace was out, and we were mutual friends. And during that time, I was, like, going from place to place to place, and the way I was getting my money, I needed someone to post ads for me, of course. And so I asked him to do it.
I just want to be really clear. You're saying that he was posting ads for work for you on Craigslist?
Yes.
And to be clear, this is before you move into Valley View, right? This is when you're...
Yeah.
This is,
mm-hmm.
Leslie, would you just tell us what was in those ads? If you don't want to talk about it, that's fine.
Just my picture and if I was available, and my phone number, basically.
Why do you think Emmanuel did that for no money?
I have no idea. I would ask him to do it for me, and he would do it. And not want anything in return. That was the most important thing.
After she moved into the Valley View, Leslie found another way to post ads. She no longer needed Emmanuel's help, but they stayed friends.
And then how does Emmanuel, before this party, how does this happen? He reaches out to you. You tell him about the party. Tell us about how that happened.
Well, his grandmother died right before that, so he was staying with friends. And they needed to go out of town. And just so happens, we were having a Halloween party. I said, well, you can just come to my house and stay for the weekend.
The party kicked off around 8 p.m. on Halloween night. Emmanuel and Leslie helped to do some setting up before separating. And eventually, they both ended up at Arpana's place. Not long after midnight, Leslie headed back downstairs, hung out for a little while longer, then said her goodbyes and went to bed.
Where did Emmanuel sleep that night?
On the couch, but he wasn't there, like, for a while. When I woke up, he was already on the couch.
Okay, and did you ever hear him come in or anything like that?
No, I was asleep, so I didn't hear him come in, no.
Got it. Okay. What about your phone? When you open it up in the morning, you have missed calls, right?
Right. And they were just, like, voicemails saying nothing.
These calls were part of what Brian Coates homed in on. Why was Emmanuel calling the person he was staying with? Why was he calling her so often? What did he want to say? Leslie still does not know.
It went on for like a couple hours. Like there was a few phone calls.
What do you think was happening there?
It sounded like a thing in his pocket. It was moving around a lot.
Did you ask him the next morning, Leslie? Did you say, hey, did you call me last night?
No. It didn't register in my mind to even think about it. Like, you know, but that was happening all the time.
The next morning, Emmanuel helped Leslie clean up the mess from the party. She remembers that he looked normal, nothing strange about him, nothing out of place. That night, she and Emmanuel watched some TV, relaxed. It wasn't until 2 days later that a friend showed up at Leslie's work and told her that there'd been an accident of some kind at the Valley View. Something had happened to Arpana. This next recollection from Leslie, I'd previously heard it from Emmanuel's perspective. The police fencing off the complex with crime scene tape, the detectives roaming the parking lot.
I'm like, what the hell? And the police came to my door and asked me if anyone else was there. I told them no, because he had a warrant and I didn't want him to go to jail. But I'm still listening to the people upstairs and I see them take her out of the place. That's when I learned that she died.
You saw them taking her out of the place, and what did you see exactly?
I just saw the stretcher pull her out. I was in shock. I couldn't believe, like, what's happened. Like, we're just all together, you know?
What did you think Emmanuel had a warrant out for?
I had no idea.
He just said, I have a warrant.
Yeah. I've had warrants before. A lot of us have warrants before, so I wasn't going to just be like, oh, he's right here, take him to jail. You don't know.
Leslie helped Emmanuel leave the apartment complex and catch a bus back to Seattle. In coming weeks, the reality of Arpanet's murder chewed away at her. The life she'd worked so hard to build, she felt it disintegrating. Now she was anxious all the time. She cried a lot. She suffered from nightmares.
Right after that, I didn't sleep in my bedroom anymore. Like, is there a killer on the loose? Is it one of my neighbors? You know, someone I know? I don't know. Yeah, I was scared. I was. I'm not gonna lie. I still am scared.
When we were talking yesterday, you said you think about this case a lot.
Yeah, every day.
Why? What do you think about?
Because if he did do it, like, I'd be like, I wonder, like, is it my fault that I brought him to this party? If it would never brought him to the party, would he still be alive?
That's a heavy burden. Can you tell us, Leslie, how soon you left Seattle after this?
Stayed for my lease, and then after that, that's when I went back to doing what I was doing before. Back to the old ways, you know? I was living in hotels. I wouldn't let nobody in my rooms or nothing like that. Came here.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Because I had to go through all the police following me everywhere I went. When they asked me questions about things, and I'm like, I didn't have any answers for them. I was asleep. And I felt bad. I didn't have no answers. I don't know what happened.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's BODi. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's BODi with an I.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In Wondery's new podcast, Killer Psyche, former FBI agent Candace DeLong dissects the motivations of the most terrifying criminals in history. In her most recent episode, Candace reviews the case of Dr. Paolo Macariani, a charming Italian surgeon who left a trail of bodies behind him. Stick around to the end of this episode to hear a preview of Killer Psyche.
Detective Brian Coates with the Redmond Police Department. I'm in an interview with Emmanuel Fair. The date is August 18th, 2009 at 10:28 hours.
19th.
Is it 19th today?
Yeah.
Okay. It is the 19th today. August 19th, 2009. Thank you, Emmanuel. Emmanuel, do I have your permission to record this interview today?
Yes.
Okay. Could you state your name, spell your last name, and give me your date of birth?
My name is Emmanuel Fair. Last name, F-A-I-R. Date of birth, 8-8-83.
Thank you. And then I'm going to advise you of your rights. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to talk to an attorney. You have the right to talk to an attorney before answering any questions and making any statements, and to have an attorney present with you during any questioning in the making of any statements. If you cannot afford an attorney, you are entitled to have an attorney appointed for you without cost.
In total, Detective Brian Coates interviewed Emmanuel Fair 3 times. The first was the interrogation shortly after the murder of Arpana Janaga. The interrogation that had started with Coates and his partner loading Emmanuel into an unmarked car at gunpoint. The second interview happened in the summer of 2009. It took place at a jail in Kent, Washington, where Emmanuel was being held for again failing to register as a sex offender. For Brian Coates, Emmanuel being behind bars was the ideal scenario. He now had time to really question Emmanuel, who, unlike Cameron Johnson, had not hired an attorney.
Here's a picture of you. Yeah. So you got a hard hat, you got a tool belt, some knee pads. Who gave you all this stuff?
The guy that stayed next door.
Coates took Emmanuel again through the night of the party, pausing to get his opinion of people like Neil, the guy who had punched Emmanuel in the lip.
Yeah.
Remember him?
Yeah, I remember him.
Do you get any kind of weird vibe off of him at all?
Not really.
The early part of this interview is friendly in the way Coates' interview with Cameron Johnson was friendly. Just two guys talking about a Halloween party, a bunch of photos laid out in front of them.
Seems like a pretty cool crowd. I mean, pretty good mix of some good people. You had some kids there. You even had some parents were there. Good mix of people.
But Emmanuel is not biting. He tells Coates he hardly knew anyone there. The party was fun, but also basically unmemorable. So Coates zeroes in on a moment that's always piqued his interest. The first meeting between Emmanuel and Cameron Johnson.
Okay. One person we talked about before, I think he showed up late. This guy showed up, he lived on the top deck, Cam.
Cam.
Remember him as Cam?
Yeah, I remember Cam.
He liked to mix the music?
Yeah, he let me listen to some of his beats. He had, like, some techno beats.
Yeah, that's right. You went out to the parking lot to his car?
Yeah.
Listened to some music?
Yeah.
How long were you out there for?
Just for about... I think he only let me listen to, like, 2 beats or something.
Okay. Yeah. And I know this is a long time ago. Would this be before midnight, after midnight?
This was before...
Before midnight?
Before.
Pretty early then.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was before midnight.
Mm-hmm.
So after midnight, you never saw him again?
I don't remember seeing him again.
Emmanuel has never changed this part of his story. Not under pressure from cops and not under questioning from his own attorneys. Coates kept probing. Okay, he said, but what about Arpana?
Who was hitting on her? Who wanted her so badly. I mean, there's some other pictures of her where she's kind of flaunting her stuff a little bit, you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? You got the picture where she's posting with you, you know, and she's showing underwear and all that stuff. I mean, she's showing it. And I'm thinking if somebody after the party is just like, I got to get me some of that, or looking at getting together with her, hooking up with her. That's what I'm thinking happened. Somebody at the party. Wouldn't you agree? Would you think it's somebody else?
I mean, I don't really though. Them people at the party seem cool, so I don't know.
Same answer from Emmanuel. Again, he doesn't know. Yeah, Cameron and Arpana were neighbors. Yeah, they flirted. But Emmanuel, in his telling, spent just over half an hour talking to both of them. They were strangers. He's just not in a position to say anything more. Which in turn causes Coates, who at this point might as well be banging his head against the wall, to employ a new technique. Let's call it the pretend for a moment you did it approach. Like the O.J. Simpson book. If you did it, Emmanuel, how would you have done it?
Let's go back to the crime scene for a minute. You gotta visualize in your head. She's in her bedroom. She's naked. She's dead. She's been strangled. And hit on the head pretty hard, raped, sexually assaulted, what have you. That's what we have. And then we have all these people at the party. So how can you help me there? You know people. You know how to read people. How do you help us with this one? Who do we look at? Do we look at Cameron?
I don't know. I can't say because I don't really know Cameron. Yeah.
Do we look at you? Would you do something like this?
Not at all. Not at all.
Near the end of the interview, Brian Coates returns to the calls Emmanuel had made in the early morning hours of November 1st. These were calls that Emmanuel had denied making in the first interview, but since had shown up on his cell phone records. Emmanuel protests. In general, he's having a hard time remembering a lot of the details from the night.
So what's the latest you were up?
Damn. So long ago.
Oh, it is. I feel bad for grilling you about putting hours of a date together that was like 9 months ago.
Finally, click. The tape turns off. Coates and Emmanuel say their goodbyes. Coates heads back to the Redmond police station and Emmanuel to his cell. Although neither know it at the time, what will happen next, the next major development in the case, will have nothing to do with timelines that Emmanuel no longer remembers or late-night phone calls. Instead, it'll hinge on DNA, that microscopic molecule that makes us who we are, that makes us entirely unique. And more specifically, DNA traces that tied the Redmond Police Department's new main suspect to the murder scene.
On the robe and in the tissue found on the floor and the DNA swab taken during autopsy of the front side of Arpana's neck, that's what prompted the state to file charges of murder.
I mentioned that Coates interviewed Emmanuel three times. The third and final interrogation would occur a few months later when Coates let Emmanuel know that he was ready to recommend murder charges against him. That's on the next episode of Suspect.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Suspect ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Campside and Wondery, this is episode 4 of 9 of Suspect. Suspect was reported by Eric Benson, Natalia Winkleman, and me, Matthew Scher. Eric and I are producers. David Waters is the executive producer. Our editor is Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Field production by Kyle Norris. Aaliyah Papes and Callie Hitchcock are assistant producers. Fact-checking by Matthew Giles. Original music by Doug Slaywin and Netta Hadari. Consulting producers are Laura Ricciardi and Josie Duffy Rice. Our engineer is Jackie Sajiko. Mixing by Jackie Sajiko, Mark McAdam, and Garrett Tiedemann. Additional production assistance from Rod Sherwood. Studio engineer is Judd Caswell at Frog Hollow Studio in Topsom, Maine. At Campside, the executive producers are me, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Josh Dean, and Adam Hoff. For Wondery, Chris Siegel is the producer. Production assistance from Fiona Pastana. Managing producer is Lata Pandya. Executive producers are George Lavender, Marshall Louie, and Jen Sargent.
You're about to hear a preview of Killer Psyche. While you're listening, make sure to follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen to new episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
I'm Candace DeLong. With a career spanning nearly 5 decades as a psychiatric nurse and FBI criminal profiler, I've sat across the table from hundreds of criminals and spent countless hours inside their minds. Now, in each episode of Killer Psyche, I'll unravel the psychology and motivation behind America's most complex and disturbing figures.
Christopher Dunch was a malignant narcissist, and they are very skilled at getting other people to do what they want. Ted Kaczynski was a killer with a cause, and that's the most dangerous kind of killer. Not unusual for serial killers to try to make the police look bad. The DC sniper's message was, the police can't protect you. And they were right. I've spent my whole life learning about criminals, what they think and how they think. And now you will too. From Wondery, the company behind Dr. Death and The Apology Line, and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or to listen to episodes ad-free and 1 week early, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all six episodes of part one and watching along with part two as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.